A flurry of movement last night in the State House with House Democrats passing their version of a budget. Barbara Flynn Curry said they had to.
But it is not possible for us to walk away from this chamber without having offered some security to the people of the state of Illinois that there will be a budget, that we can govern the state.
Republican floor leader Representative Ron Sandeck offered this counter about last night.
It was Illinois government at its worst, and I'm hoping today is literally and figuratively a new day.
We'll talk about what's next. Also, what Illinois researchers are doing to help cure brain cancer.
They saw a tumor. The next day, they went in and did a biopsy of it, and they told us that it was anaplastic astrocytoma.
We speak with caregivers, researchers, and doctors about the challenges of working on treating a disease that kills about 15,000 Americans each year. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everybody's staying dry out there today. Surprise movement last night from the State House with House Democrats passing their version of a budget. Chicago Democrat Representative Barbara Flynn Curry said they had to.
But it is not possible for us to walk away from this chamber without having offered some security to the people of the state of Illinois that there will be a budget, that we can govern the state, and that vulnerable populations will find that their needs can be met.
Later in the hour, we speak with House Republican floor leader Ron Sandeck about what's next and get more analysis on whether or not we'll actually have a budget with Reboot Illinois' Madeline Dubek. Like many forms of cancer, brain cancer can be devastating. The most aggressive forms, like glioblastoma, are terminal. About 15,000 people in the U.S. die from brain cancer every year. And treatments for brain cancer are limited. That's because not all chemotherapy drugs are able to penetrate the brain. Illinois researchers are working on the development of a new drug that could improve or save lives. We're going to speak with a few of those scientists in a few minutes. But first, we're joined by Brenda O'Brien, who's on the line with us from St. Louis. Brenda lost both her fiancé and mother to brain cancer in the past year. Brenda, thank you so much for being willing to share your experience with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm glad to be able to tell it. I mean, if it helps somebody, then I am all for it.
And I am so sorry to hear of your loss, because it's not just one but two family members that you lost to the same type of cancer. How did you initially find out that your fiancé Pete had a brain tumor?
Well, he was displaying different behaviors, and there were different behaviors being done at work and at home, and nobody had put the story together until he had taken a trip and he had become lost. And this was definitely not like him, and his behavior became very erratic, almost like he suffered some sort of seizure or some sort of memory loss. We actually had to find him and take him to the hospital, and at that time is when they told us he had a brain tumor, and we thought it was from an infection from his tooth, because he'd been battling that for over a year. So it was devastating to, you know, and very much a bad surprise to find out that this is what it was.
And what kind of prognosis did they give him at that point?
They told him at that time, after they did the biopsy, he had 7 to 10 months, and that was with treatment, the standard treatment that they had, you know, outlined for him.
Wow. So what kind of toll did those treatments and then obviously the disease itself take on Pete?
Well, initially, you know, the tumor itself had left him with the inability to make decisions. So him to rationalize and know what was going on with him sometimes was a very big issue in itself. The radiation we found made him very tired. He had 6 weeks of radiation, 5 days a week, and, you know, he had, you know, just irritating, you know, issues with his scalp and everything like that, but it would fatigue him to the point where he could sleep all day. And then once they started the chemo, which was the Timidor, a sort of 523 program, the Timidor could make him nauseous or vomit or sleep or become incontinent, but that was once a month for like 7 months. And then we went to a specialist hospital, Duke University, to see if there was any other options for him. And at that time, they added another drug to his regimen, and that was to be given every 2 weeks. And that was even worse, because on top of the Timidor, you're now getting this other drug, and you know, we didn't know if the side effects were from his tumor or if the side effects were from the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So on a daily basis, it was a chore to figure out what was going on with him and if we needed to do something or if there was something that we could do for him.
Brenda, was that initial prognosis, did that turn out to be accurate? Did Pete have about 7 to 10 months? How long did he survive?
Actually, he lived 16 months, and, you know, we were blessed to have him for that long. We didn't, you know, we actually thought 7 to 10 months, you know, this is it, this is all we get, you know, and when he outlived that, we were very, very happy and very blessed to have him for that long.
And then, unfortunately, you heard news about your mother last April, that year the doctors had discovered that she had a brain tumor as well, and I understand the timing of that was actually 2 days before Pete passed.
Correct.
I can't imagine how devastating that must have been for you. I wonder, yeah.
You don't think that it can happen to you once, much less twice. And two unrelated people, you know, my fiance and my mom, and the differences between the two of them, I mean, lifestyle-wise, if you think that, you know, cancer is caused by lifestyle, they couldn't have been more polar opposite of each other. So for this, it was just, you know, initially they found the tumors. They had to go in to do the biopsy to confirm it. And the initial thinking was that it wasn't glioblastoma. So, but in the back of my mind, it was just something I knew. And, you know, from the time that she had gotten a CT scan done in April, 2 days before he died, and said that there was tumors, that June 1st was the first that she had the biopsy that we learned positively that it was glioblastoma. And it was just unbelievable. I mean, you're reeling from the death of your fiancé, and now you have to face it with your mom.
Brenda, I can't even imagine how hard this is for you to even talk about this. And it's such a personal thing, as you said. It's your mom and your fiancé. And I just wanted to ask why you think it's important for people to hear your story.
I think unless you've gone through it and you realize that once you're diagnosed with this, it is very difficult to even fathom what you have to go through as a caregiver for these victims, patients, whatever, and you have to ask for help because it is consuming. You have to be there every step of the way. You also have to manage to do everything else in your life and their life. And, you know, I think things need to change because this is not a cancer like lung cancer or pancreatic cancer. I mean, these people are not able to voice their own needs as someone with lung cancer. My father passed away from lung cancer, so I know, you know, the difference between the two are so night and day difference on how they're treated and how they're able to make their own decisions to some extent, whereas people with glioblastoma, you know, their brain is affected. They are not able to make some of those decisions. And as it progresses, and it's such a short time period, and there are no new drugs out there available to the current population, that, you know, it just needs to have further funding and further voice for people out there to be able to know that, you know, this needs attention because it is a devastating disease. And, you know, no one should have to go through this ever.
No one should. And we really appreciate you sharing your story with us. That's Brenda O'Brien from St. Louis. Take care, Brenda. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
As Brenda said, it is a short time period. And as she said, you know, she's, from her perspective, there's no new drugs on this. And that's what we wanted to talk about now. We wanted to switch gears and talk to two researchers who are working on the development of new treatments for brain cancer. And they're doing that right here in Illinois. Paul Hergenrother is a chemistry professor at the University of Illinois. And for more than a decade, he's been leading an effort to develop a new drug for treating brain cancer. It goes by the name PAC-1. Paul's in studio with us to talk about that and the challenges of cancer research. Thanks for taking the time to be with us, Paul.
No problem.
On the line with us from Chicago is Dr. Eric Dudick, Director of the Oncology Clinical Trials Office at UIC, where the drug is currently in the middle of clinical trials. Dr. Dudick, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us as well.
Good morning.
Dr. Dudick, I wonder if we can start with you, because we just heard from Brenda about not just how devastating brain cancer can be, but also she shared a little bit about how quickly the disease can be fatal and talked about a little of the treatment. I wonder if we can take a step back and you can explain what makes brain cancer different from other types of cancer.
This unfortunate story that we've heard this morning is very often seen by us here oncologists. And the reason for this unique situation where the cancer progresses very fast despite surgical treatment or radiation treatment or chemotherapy is that it spreads along the blood vessels within the brain and does not form a very easily visible mass that can be completely resected. So, unfortunately, more commonly, we see a situation of a brain tumor recurrence after hopeful surgery or radiation therapy. There are new places that this cancer comes back. And this is because of this nature of migration of cancer cells from the initial site of disease to other sites along the blood vessels to another parts of the brain.
Dr. Dudek, what is the prognosis for patients with the most aggressive forms of brain cancer, given the treatments that are currently available? Is it typical for what Brenda described?
Unfortunately, this is a very typical story. In spite of therapies that we have developed, surgical treatments, development of new devices, the radiation therapy advances, and addition of chemotherapy agents as well as a antibody that will trim off the blood vessels formation within tumor, still we have a very poor outcomes. And in majority of our patients with brain tumors.
That's Dr. Dudek. He's the director of Oncology Clinical Trials Office at the University of Illinois in Chicago, in studio with me in Champaign-Urbana. Paul, you founded a company, Vanquish Oncology, and you recently just received a $7 million angel investment to continue clinical testing of this PAC-1 trials. It's taking place at UIC and Johns Hopkins University. I wonder if you can put that in perspective, that $7 million, before we get into what the drug, the science of the drug, I wonder how much does it cost to take a drug from the bench to the marketplace, and how much does that $7 million help when we're talking about something like brain cancer?
Yeah, it's a good question. The, you know, taking it from the bench to the initial human studies, we had an initial $4 million investment, and that allowed us to do the compound synthesis and then generation of the preclinical toxicology data that the FDA requires. And so that was great, and the compound is currently in clinical trials at University of Illinois Cancer Center in Chicago and at Johns Hopkins. So the other $7 million now, the idea is to expand that and expand that specifically to patients with glioblastoma at those two sites.
And the timeline for that is when we're thinking about you're in clinical trials, what's for people, is it typically a process that would take anywhere from 3 to 5 years? Is it longer?
Yeah, it's hard to say because there's one typically does a dose escalation where patients are in succession given higher and higher doses. And so that's a little bit unpredictable. But yes, the 3 to 5 year timeline for really knowing something definitive, I'd say, is typical.
And what makes PAC-1 different from other treatments for brain cancer?
Well, as far as brain cancer is concerned, the thing that we think is a positive for the compound is that it does penetrate the blood-brain barrier. So as you mentioned at the outset, a lot of therapeutics, most all therapeutics, do not get into the brain, and therefore there's a very, very limited number that are used for brain cancer. Brenda mentioned Temodar or temozolomide, and that is the kind of standard of care. And we have found in preclinical studies that PAC-1 does penetrate the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain, and that it synergizes, so it enhances the activity of Temodar. So, you know, that's what the trial will be, the combination of those two.
Dr. Dudek, I wonder if you can explain, or I'm not sure if you or Paul should answer this, how many patients have received PAC-1 and how the trials are going so far?
The trial is going very well. So right now we are at the next cohort level. We have not seen any significant safety issues, so I'm very happy to go up to the higher dose level. This study is very carefully performed with numbers of monitoring neurological evaluations. And so far, we have not seen any toxicity, which is very exciting because we can go up to the higher dose levels that perhaps will be even more efficient. We have divided this study into two parts. The first part, we are just studying the single agent. And in the second part, will be much more applicable to patients, to individuals with brain tumors, is going to be combined with temozolomide, with an idea behind, as Paul mentioned, that temozolomide is going to push cancer cells toward dying, and the PAC-1 will be adding to this and opening the pathway for cancer death.
Paul, how many years have you been working on this?
We've been working on it over 10 years now, about 12 or 13 years.
And what motivated you specifically to focus on brain cancer?
Well, I think, you know, as we heard the heart-wrenching story today, and that's, as Arik mentioned, is very typical, just the intractable nature of that disease. And then, you know, taking advantage of this feature, this trait of PAC-1, the ability to get into the brain.
When we come back, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Paul Hergenrother and with Dr. Arik Dudik from UIC on clinical trials. And what we're going to talk about is particularly brain cancer, because it's fatal for about 15,000 people in the U.S. a year, how hard it is to develop treatments when it's a smaller subset of the population. So stay tuned to the 21st. We're going to continue this conversation in just a few minutes.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the devastating toll that brain cancer can take on patients and families, and we're learning about the development of new treatments for brain cancer with University of Illinois chemistry professor and researcher Paul Hergenrother. On the line with us from Chicago, Dr. Arik Dudik is the director of oncology, I'm going to be able to say that, clinical trials at UIC. And Paul, I wonder if you could just explain the treatment that you all are developing. This PAC-1 drug falls into a category that the FDA calls orphan drugs or orphan treatment.
Right.
Can you explain what that means?
Sure. Yeah, it's a category in a, that the FDA has made to encourage development for drugs that afflict a smaller subset of the population. So in that case, 200,000 or less. And if one gets orphan drug designation for your drug, which we recently received for PAC-1, that gives certain regulatory advantages as far as discussions with the FDA, hopefully moving more rapidly through the approval process.
Has that been the case for you all?
We think so, yes. So we're just, you know, we just recently received that orphan drug designation, and so we'll be taking advantage of that as we attempt to move the compound forward for treatment of glioblastoma.
And do you think that the FDA needs to do this because you don't see people, pharmaceutical companies necessarily devoting as much research and development to this because of the proportionally small number of the population that's affected by something like brain cancer?
Yeah, that's the logic. So for something, a very difficult problem such as brain cancer and glioblastoma in particular, and it's also a small market. So just from a business perspective, it's kind of a very challenging and maybe not a great business proposition. So the FDA does these things to incentivize development for these types of diseases.
Dr. Dudik, what are the next steps for PAC-1 for you all?
Well, we'd like to finish our phase one part, and once we have information about safe doses and that have efficacy as a single agent as well as a combination with temozolomide, we would like to rapidly move on to the larger study that will confirm activity of this medication for brain tumors. We are already forming a network with Johns Hopkins University, and we'll probably expand this to other places that are specializing in brain tumor therapy in order to have a fast accrual of this to this study.
Paul, when we hear about cancer in the news, there's a lot of talk using the word cure. And earlier in the year, President Obama announced a moonshot to cure cancer. Is cancer something that can be cured? Are we mostly, particularly in the case of brain cancer, are we talking about improving prognoses or lengthening the amount of time before the disease eventually becomes fatal?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the history of cancer drug discovery and cancer research, certainly diseases that were viewed as incurable have been cured or you know, tremendously improved prognosis. Certain white blood cell cancers, for example, just 10 years ago, that were thought to be incurable are now kind of to the point where they're very, very treatable in a very successful way. So one never wants to say never about these things. And obviously, that's what we hope to do. But typically, there's a progression where each new drug gets a little bit better result.
That's Paul Hergenrother. He's a chemistry professor at the University of Illinois and also has his company, Vanquish Oncology, working on these PAC-1 drug treatments for brain cancer. I want to thank you as well as Dr. Eric Dudick from UIC. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You know, as we were talking about this issue of brain cancer and the development of treatments, and Paul brought up this notion of orphan drugs or orphan diseases. In 1983, the FDA established what's called the Orphan Drug Act to give companies certain incentives and to help speed up the development of new drugs for rare diseases like brain cancer or other illnesses. As Paul said, it's for illnesses that affect fewer than 200,000 people. Since then, the agency has actually designated more than 3,600 drugs as orphan drugs, and more than 500 of those have gotten approved and are making their way into the commercial market. Joining us to talk about this broader issue is Ed Silverman. He's a senior writer for Stat News and has 2 decades of experience covering the pharmaceutical industry. He's on the line from New Jersey. Hey, Ed, welcome to the 21st. Ed? Ed, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Ed.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you fine. Last year, you know, the FDA received the most requests it's ever received from companies to have their medicines designated as orphan drugs. Can you help us understand what exactly are the incentives that the FDA is offering companies to develop new drugs for rare diseases?
Well, the agency offers some pretty big and important incentives if you're a drug maker, big or small. One would be tax credits. Simply put, you get an orphan drug approved by the FDA, and you'll be able to get credits on your taxes, and that adds up quickly. And then the other is something that's called market exclusivity, which is a wonky regulatory term, but it's very important because it gives a company 7 years of monopoly. Basically, if you get your orphan drug approved, no other company will be able to get FDA approval for the same type of drug. It doesn't mean another company could not go to the FDA to get a different type of drug to treat the same disease approved. There's a distinction there. But it does preclude something like generic.
Right. So essentially they have a lock on the patent for 7 years is what you're saying. There won't be any other generics.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's a monopoly of sorts.
Without those incentives, do you think it would be too big a risk for pharmaceutical companies to invest in the development of drugs that might not end up making very much money, even if we're talking about life-saving treatment?
Well, it's hard to give a blanket answer to that. I don't think it's all or nothing. I think that the potential payback in terms of sales, future sales, can be pretty strong because often OFTEN, often these drugs are sold at rather high prices. So even though it's a small patient population, you can make a profit fairly soon, or at least soon enough to recover the investment. I do think that the exclusivity is a huge incentive. I think removing that or altering it in a way that's significant would probably engender a lot of protests from the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know in your reporting on this, you've encountered people who were concerned about loopholes in the Orphan Drug Act. What are those loopholes?
Well, when you get your drug approved, your orphan drug approved by the FDA, that means it's endorsed to use for a specific condition. And what happens, though, in the real world is that a doctor might find that that same drug can actually be useful in treating yet another condition. That's called off-label use. It's not a use that's specified on the product labeling that is issued at the time a drug is approved. That's legal. A doctor can do that. However, what some critics say is happening increasingly is that drug companies are getting a drug approved for a particular orphan use, and they have that small patient population. But they may later go back and win FDA approval for yet another use for the same drug and can greatly widen the patient population and ring the register how many more times, we don't know, but lots more. And so the complaint there is that the companies, or some companies in some instances, are using the orphan designation and approval as a foot in the door. They get that first smaller patient population and potential revenue kick, but they use that to leverage a much wider potential patient population that can bring in X many times sales than they originally experienced. And some critics say that it's unfair.
Yeah, I that makes sense. Ed, we just have a few minutes left, but I wonder if you could just sort of explain for us. There's, you know, I get that side, but then obviously we hear the other side of patients and families. Particularly, we started this conversation talking about brain cancer and how devastating that can be and how hard it has been to find treatments. I wonder, in your opinion, if you think what kind of reforms are needed by the FDA, if the Orphan Drug Act is sufficient to help these categories of if the government's doing a good enough role trying to work with the pharmaceutical industry to provide enough incentives for R&D for these kind of treatments?
Well, I think that I think the agency is trying harder in general to work with companies and work with patients and families. That's gradually playing out, sometimes more publicly than other times. So I think that in general, the agency is more attuned to these sorts of concerns. Certainly over the last number of years, the last decade, we've seen a lot more activity and pressure from all directions placed on the agency to do a better job of looking at rare diseases and trying to get those drugs through the approval process. And the orphan drug designation is just one tool to make that happen. So I think Congress could probably work on closing a couple of the loopholes. I think maybe there should be taxes levied of some sort on drugs that exceed a certain revenue, or maybe shorten the market exclusivity somewhat. But this would have to be sorted out, because once something like that is mandated by law, the implications ripple out in different directions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then it takes things like acts of Congress and other things to kind of do further regulation and incentives on top of it. Well, thanks so much. We appreciate your perspective on this. Ed Silverman is a senior writer for Stat News on orphan drugs and orphan drug treatment in the FDA. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Last night, we saw a flurry of activity among House Democrats in Springfield. They rammed through a 500-page version of a budget on a largely partisan 63-53 vote. We heard from Democrat Barbara Flynn Curry at the beginning of today's program, saying Democratic lawmakers felt they couldn't leave chambers without a budget for the state. Republicans have howled at the last-minute politicking that produced this version of a budget last night. Earlier this morning, I spoke with Republican floor leader Ron Sandek. He represents Downers Grove. I started by asking him what happened last night.
what happened last night was democracy at its worst. The majority party, amid collegial, professional conversations towards seeking to get a compromise on a budget and reforms, decided, and that really means Speaker Madigan, decided to short-circuit the process, throw cold water on that bipartisan process, and basically rammed a $40 billion spending plan. I won't call it a budget because it doesn't balance down the minority party's throat. That $40 billion spending plan, admittedly, only has $33 billion in revenues. So it, by simple math, is $7 billion out of budget on fiscal year 2017. You add in that we got $7.6 billion in unpaid bills right now. Essentially, the majority Democrats are doubling down on the fiscal insanity. You know, and there were procedural goofiness and wackiness that happened last night, too. Nyla, it was Illinois government at its worst, and I'm hoping today is literally and figuratively a new day.
Well, Representative Sandek, you're the Republican floor leader. This is now, I guess, through the House. What do you expect? What are next steps now? What do you want to see happen? As you said, you felt like you were working on compromises. So
right.
Where does this leave everybody now?
Well, today, Nyla, I have a 10 o'clock, a noon, and 6 p.m. meeting, bipartisan, bicameral, on several reform working groups to try and tie into what some budget working groups, these are rank and file members, by the way, have already put together in a continuing effort to come together on a budget and reform package that is palatable to both the Senate and the House and will be signed by the governor. This is no small feat. Anyone that can do math will agree that we need cuts. Yes, we need revenues. But we also need reforms. And if we can find the right mixture, the ingredients of those three items, we really can get past this deadlock, despite the Speaker Madigan's intentions on not having that happen. So I'm going to continue to work with Democrats and Republicans, senators and House members, towards compromise. We have a few days left. I intend to use my time as wisely as possible.
Do you think those 500 pages yesterday evening represent another starting point, or are you
No.
just...
I think that represents an attempt by the Speaker to herd in his caucus, throw cold water on a process he does not want to have happen. I think he's letting members and his caucus and others know who's who in the zoo. I'm hoping a polite uprising will occur with House Democrats. We need rank and file members to get together because some caucus leaders do not want a deal. They think there's political gain to be had come November. Many of us see the political gain as being actually a loss for the state. We're hemorrhaging money. We're losing people. There is a malaise that's unmistakable, palpable, that shrouds the state. We need a budget. We need reforms. We need a path for prosperity. We need to turn the state around. I know, irrespective of partisan politics, people on both sides of the aisle understand this, and I'm going to hope and pray we can use our time wisely to get there.
State Representative Ron Sandek represents Downers Grove. Thanks for being with us from Springfield, I should say. Thank you.
My pleasure, Nyla, as always. Take care.
Coming up, Reboot Illinois' Madeline Dubeck joins us to talk about what's next. We want to hear from you on this as well. What do you think should be happening in Springfield? What do you think about what happened last night? You can always tweet us. Our Twitter handle is 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. Or if you want to give us a call, you could do that too. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Coming up the last few minutes of the 21st, we're going to be talking about what's next in Springfield in the State House and giving you some more analysis on it. You're listening to the 21st. Stay tuned.
The
21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boudou. We're days away from the end of the legislative session in Springfield, and after last night, it's not really clear if we're closer to resolving this budget impasse. Of course, there are also other items on the agenda for the end of session. Right now, lawmakers are right now debating about regulating fantasy sports, but there's also discussions about school funding, road maintenance, marijuana decriminalization. To break it down for all of you, we've got veteran journalist Madeline Dubick with us. She's now chief operating officer of Reboot Illinois. Madeline, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. How are you?
I'm great. Well, let's talk about how everything's going in Springfield. What do you think the standards are for you? What do you think the mood is actually today in Springfield after what happened last night?
The mood, I would say it's like everybody has a gigantic $7 billion hangover.
Because that $7 billion is obviously the difference in what Democrats proposed last night. I mean, is that what stands out for you with what was passed by the House last night?
Yes. I mean, I think that it's just insanity happening there, that we keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome, and that the Speaker obviously so clearly is more concerned about dinging the governor and politics and power is you know, alarming. By all accounts, when you see some Democrats coming off this bill and other people just being so confused about the way in which it was quickly rammed through, you know, I think you kind of have to really sit back and think about that and wonder what we've come to here.
What do we see in this version of what was passed last night, Madeline? Do you think it's really a reflection of Speaker Madigan that, you know, recently has said he's willing to negotiate on property tax freezes, on pension reform and workers' comp? These have been the big sticking points in this, you know, almost 11-month battle now between him and between Governor Rauner. Did we see any movement on any of this and what was passed by the House last night?
Not that I'm aware of. Like many of the lawmakers who voted on this yesterday, I have not read the 500-page bill, so I can't say for certain. But I don't see anything in there that says that. And you know, the speaker came out of his brief meeting with the governor and the other legislative leaders yesterday, and said his agents were not being persuasive, and then proceeded to introduce this amendment and push it through last night. So it provides a lot more money for Chicago Public Schools and for schooling in general, but it does not do any of those, make an attempt to kind of bridge the gap on those three things that it seemed as if for a day or two there might be some hope for.
So let's, before we get to if whether or not there's any hope, I just have a question about that $700 million for schools that was in there. Because the question I wonder is, if Governor Rauner were to veto this budget, he does risk not having funding for schools to open this fall. And do you think that's the gamble that Speaker Madigan was making yesterday evening?
Definitely. I think that's the case. And you know, I wonder personally whether it might not be a good thing if he did veto that and schools were threatened with being closed, because I think that is the kind of wake-up call that it's going to take to put pressure on all of these lawmakers to knock off this political nonsense and get something done. You know, most people around the state, are kids are going to school and they're going to their jobs, and they don't really see this gamesmanship affecting them in any way. If K-12 schools are threatened with not opening, and most of them need to begin planning how to do that around July, then I think we're finally going to see people start rising up and demanding that this be resolved.
When you say uprising, that makes me think of Representative Sandek's words. He said he's hoping to see a polite uprising, and he, you know, obviously said he's been in these rank-and-file conversations working as a Republican with his Democratic counterparts. And what do you think this does to all of these other conversations that we, you know, it's not clear how much movement there has been, but that the notion of the rank-and-file lawmakers, apart from leadership, are working on solutions towards this?
You know, we witnessed a couple weeks ago, Nyla, rank-and-file members rise up against the speaker and against the governor and get at least some Band-Aid temporary funding to our college, public college and university system. I think that was pretty significant and gives some hope that this can be done again. You know, that's kind of the key to all of this is people putting pressure on their rank and file lawmakers, because if enough of them do so and they tell Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton and the Republican leaders that they're feeling like they're being threatened and may not win re-election, that is what Speaker Madigan and others listen to, and that is when they back down. So,
Madeline,
that could happen.
That's what I'm curious about, though. This is, you have a perspective of having covered politics in Illinois for some time. Do you have a sense that at this moment in Springfield, lawmakers do not feel that kind of pressure to get something done by their constituents?
I don't think they feel enough pressure. I think they have felt some pressure. I think that they have a sense that people are generally disgusted and fed up by this. But, you know, the way the map is drawn, not very many of them, they could pretty much vote any way they wanted to and still win re-election, because the way the map is drawn, there are some key districts around the state, obviously, where there will be some competitive elections, and that is where the pressure needs to come from. I spoke to State Representative Elaine Nekritz earlier this week when the governor suggested publicly that she was one of the Democrats who was ready to vote for some reforms along with some new revenue and some cuts to spending. And she told me essentially that when she is back home talking to her constituents, they are disgusted and aware that there's a mess and that there's no budget, but they aren't necessarily aware that something really needs to happen by May 31st. And so, you know, I think a whole lot more people would really understand the situation if suddenly they were getting emails from their principals and school superintendents saying, look, we may not be able to open in August.
And you think so? And I wonder if that's where, and it sounds like you're thinking that's, we've heard discussion about the need of a crisis and having the situation at Chicago State University laying off a third of its staff so far has been one of the most significant developments to date. But you think it's really needs to be something like K through 12 schools. Maybe you think that will really create a sense of awareness among people that this is a pretty bad situation we're in?
I do, you know, because that's a much bigger population that is affected than just the situation at Chicago State. But I think the situation at Chicago State and 300 layoffs at my alma mater, Eastern Illinois University, and cuts and more layoffs at Western Illinois University, there was a groundswell there for several weeks where all the people in those communities were rising up and complaining, and it very clearly had an effect. We were getting to the point there where entire communities built up around those schools were you know, getting ready to collapse. And it's going to take something like that, I think, to push these guys off of their political power plays.
Madeline, as we're talking about this budget discussion, there are actually other laws being debated and passed right now in the State House. I wonder if you think it's even odd that they're doing all of these other things, the discussion that's going on right now at this moment about fantasy sports. We've heard conversations about school funding, which, of course, is related to the budget. But there's discussions about road maintenance, about decriminalizing marijuana. Do you think it's odd that they're doing all of these other things, or is it also just kind of the function of state government that there are other things that need to be discussed?
Well, Nyla, I think the answer is kind of both, actually. You know, it is the normal function of state government to get some of these other things done. But at the same time, I certainly think it's kind of an odd commentary that we are worrying so much about fantasy sports right now when we are in such a crisis in the state of Illinois. But, you know, nonetheless, you see the fantasy sports people bringing down and hiring every lobbyist they can get their hands on, bringing in Frank Thomas, bringing in Chris Chelios, in order to get this thing done and regulated and up and running. And there definitely are moments when you think that this whole situation is just silly and surreal.
I did want to ask you about school funding, because there was a school funding proposal that passed the House in May that would send state money to school districts that can't raise the funds through property taxes. And obviously that's something that Andy Menar has been really working very hard on. Governor Rauner.
That's the Senate, Nyla.
Right,
yes. You said the House.
Yeah, so. No, sorry. I meant the House and now moving to the Senate. Right. Yeah. So I wonder.
Other way around.
Sorry, yes.
Pass the Senate, moving
sorry.
To the House.
Okay, sorry, that's a thanks. I was like, Senator Menar, but I meant to say Senate there. I didn't realize I said House. Thanks for that, Madeline. Now,
sure.
I just wonder, as we're thinking about this moving forward, if you think that this school funding proposal, if that conversation will be even, if that can happen in contingent with all the budget conversations, or it just seems like there's so many problems right now in the state. It just seems like, are the big issues even going to be tackled?
It certainly doesn't look that way from this vantage point after what happened yesterday, which is an absolute crime. This is a problem that we've seen and seen kids in schools downstate suffer for 30 years. I mean, literally, Nyla, when I was a political reporter at the Daily Herald in the 1990s, this was an issue. And they did something about it, I think, around 1995, but not enough and not a significant enough change. And, you know, we all decided as a society long ago that public education is, you know, one of the major compacts of living in this country and in the state. And the state has never met its obligation to fund it properly. And to me, that's one of the keys of really turning the state around. If you have a situation where some schools and some kids are not getting remotely close to a fair share of funding in order to give them a decent education, it's a social justice issue. And the fact that this is going to get caught up yet again in all of this other nonsense is just a shame. I mean, I think there is, Andy Menar has worked on this bill for a long time. It's probably not quite there yet, but there are some pretty simple compromises that could be worked out to get this done, and it seems to have all been flushed away in the last 48 hours or so.
Do you have any sense of how you think the next 48 hours will go? And by that, I mean to Friday and Tuesday before the May 31st deadline?
Unless more House Democrats really rise up and make a personal appeal to the Speaker and tell them they want to try to get something done, I don't see a whole lot changing. I think we'll continue to see Speaker Madigan run bills that will make Republicans and the governor look bad in the fall election. And it's pretty clear from what he did yesterday that this is all about the November election to him. And so unless there is kind of a rank-and-file uprising backed by constituents, I don't see a whole lot changing. I think they'll try to get something through. We'll see what the Senate does with this bill the House passed today. And they may send it to the governor and wait for him to veto it.
That's Madeline Dubek, Chief Operating Officer of Reboot Illinois. Madeline, thanks for being with me.
Anytime. Thank you, Nyla.
We'll continue this conversation about what's happening in Springfield tomorrow on the 21st. We'll also be speaking with veteran business owners, so stay tuned for that. For today, thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo.